Devoncast
from Radio X.
Welcome to Devoncast, the podcast that wades through Devon's political rivers so you don't have to, and brings a host of important stories straight to you from across the county. Devoncast is brought to you by Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. I'm Bradley Gerrard, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Alison Stevenson.
This week we have a guest in the studio with us, so we'll be speaking shortly with Councillor Kevin Blakey, who represents Cranbrook on East Devon District Council, and delving into the latest goings-on in Devon's newest town.
We'll also be discussing a controversial planning application in Fenerton that residents and councillors there believe should not have been approved. We'll get an update ahead of Budleigh Salterton's Literary Festival, and we'll add a European flavour to the podcast with news about Plymouth's new link with Finland.
Plus, we'll drop in a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down, thanks to our Radio X colleague Jamie Taylor, who caught up with Mary Poppins' leading lady, Stephanie Jones, who'll be fronting the Theatre Royal production.
But first, it's welcome to our guest, Councillor Kevin Blakey, an independent councillor on East Devon District Council, representing Cranbrook since 2019. He's also on the Town Council for Cranbrook, which has just submitted a request to expand its boundaries. I was wondering, Councillor Blakey, can you tell us a bit more about that in terms of what it could mean for the town and when things might happen?
Well, the process is unfortunately quite long. It means we're going to be waiting for up to 12 months for a decision on this. But the reason for asking for a review from the Town Council is that, as I think a lot of people will know, Cranbrook is going to be expanding into several expansion zones, taking it from its original 3,500 houses up to eventually 8,500 houses over four expansion areas.
So this application to expand the boundaries is to accommodate that new development, is it?
Yes, exactly that, because it makes no sense to the councillors on the Town Council that there will be a town which is really quite obviously one town in Cranbrook, which would then have its local governance at the hands of four or five different councils. The Town Council will continue to manage the original area, if you like, the 3,500, but it could be, depending on which way the review goes, that the expansion zones will be under the control of the surrounding parish councils where the land currently sits.
OK, so it's kind of designed to make sure that all of the houses that qualify under the name Cranbrook, so to speak, are overseen by one sort of tier of government, or one local authority, rather.
Yeah, that's the idea from the Town Council's perspective, and I think it's fairly logical, but we do understand that there are reasons that the surrounding parishes may not want that to happen.
And Cranbrook first made the request in 2021 to expand its boundaries, I believe, looking back through some council papers. What's taken so long?
Yes, they did. And at the time, the chief executive at East Devon District Council, whose responsibility it is to run this thing, decided that the time was not right. There were impending elections and there were other political changes taking place. He felt that the time was not right. And perhaps the biggest influence was the fact that at the time, a very large planning application was being sifted through, which is what resulted in the Cranbrook Extended Master Plan. And his decision was that until that master plan had been published and approved by government, that a boundary review really wasn't appropriate.
Can I ask, is it a sensible time to be expanding boundaries at Cranbrook given the local government reorganisation that's been sparked by Westminster, which essentially, to remind listeners, wants to create fewer but larger councils across England and is going to create the biggest upheaval and shake-up of local government in about 50 years?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting time, but as far as town and parish councils are concerned, there's been no mention so far of any changes that are going to take place. So, in fact, regardless of who the next tier of government is, and we will assume that for the moment that it's going to be a unitary authority, at town council level, it's business as usual. We don't know of any plans from government to make changes to local representation at the lowest level. So we just crack on.
Sure. So what you're doing in Cranbrook then and regarding the boundaries makes sense to do now. It isn't illogical in any way, in your view?
No, not at all, because let's assume for a moment that the boundaries do change, then the unitary authority or whatever replaces East Devon District Council and Devon County Council will simply take over whatever has happened historically and whatever the town and parish boundaries are at that time.
In terms of Cranbrook itself, the first residents moved in around 12 years ago, but the town has only now just got its supermarket in December last year, actually. What took so long for that to happen? And is there anything the district or town council could have done differently?
In one word, money. But the longer explanation is, yes, things could have been done differently. And I think that the district council, they're the planning authority and they're the people who arranged for Cranbrook to be built in the first place. I think that if they understood then what they understand now, it would have been done differently, I think, because the model that was used to develop and build Cranbrook was essentially to hand it over to developers with certain constraints to get on and supply it. That left control of the timescale really out of the council's hands and very much in the developers' hands. And it would come as no surprise to anyone that the developers want to build houses in advance of doing anything else. So the time it has taken has been down to a number of factors, but the provision of the land and then the provision of the money to develop the site, a key amongst those.
You've mentioned money a couple of times there. What exactly, from whom and how much kind of was lacking in relation to Cranbrook then?
Essentially comes from what are called Section 106 agreements, which are agreements between the council and the developers. The developers are obliged under those agreements to provide all sorts of things. That can include roads, schools, all sorts of other infrastructure. The Section 106 agreement for the original Cranbrook still includes a requirement to provide extra medical space, the health centre, and so on. So those things have still yet to be built.
I was going to say, yeah, so they're in the waiting still.
Yes, and actually you then get into the complexity of which particular level of government is actually in control of it, because things like the library and the family centres, just as four examples, they would be brought on by Devon County Council rather than East Devon District Council. So there are conversations going on between them and the town council all the while to try to work out exactly when these things are going to be provided and where. And certainly as far as the town centre development is concerned, because if we go back to the supermarket, that was an obligation to provide the land to get the town centre built, but there wasn't an obligation to build the buildings themselves. So developers had to be brought in from the outside. And of course, the developers don't want to build very large investment buildings like a supermarket until the footfall is there, until the people are there to actually use the place so that they make their business viable.
So what about Cranbrook itself, which is going to be a development of small business units and shops in the centre of the town? The town found out in November it'd be getting just over 1.9 million for Cranbrook, which is obviously great news. But again, how has it taken this long to get something that's so integral to the town centre?
The idea of Cranbrook has actually been an idea that's been in formation since even the town council was formed. I'm going to claim a bit of credit for that, because there was a few of us that got together and thought, how can we get the town centre going, get business going? And we thought that what Cranbrook needs is something which would be affordable for the tenants and which would give them the opportunity to start a business with an ethos that says that you can afford to fail. You can start a business. If it goes wrong, you're not going to lose everything. The terms of the leases would be such that you could walk away without doing yourself too much damage. The number of small businesses that operate in Cranbrook now is quite phenomenal. Most of them are operating out of people's back rooms or bedrooms or garages. And some of them do need some extra space. So we've been looking for a way to get these kind of spaces into the town centre. Really, the idea has come from what we've seen in other towns and cities, but where they use things like shipping containers to provide modular spaces. And we are in the process now of finally getting towards that point. We would have loved to have brought this forward much sooner, but the fact was that the figures just didn't stack up. And the funding that we've now managed to achieve to do this is going to make it happen. And we're under a very tight timescale on this. Things are happening daily at the moment. And I think it's most likely, I'm not going to stake a large wager on this.
Give us a deadline.
I'm not going to stake my house on this, but I think we can expect to see the first delivery by the end of this year.
Okay. And can you explain a bit more to people listening who might not know what Crown Box is going to be? You've mentioned obviously a hub for small businesses, but what else will it be?
Yeah, the idea is that they are relatively small spaces. We're looking at units which will be about 3 metres wide and 8 or 9 metres long, into which any kind of enterprise can go into them. So it could be some kind of social space. You know, you're talking about bar, cafe, restaurant, something of that sort. Anything from a bicycle repair shop to a hairdresser's to a solicitor's office. Really, we don't have a prescriptive view on what's going to go in them. It's going to be a case of, well, who wants one? Who's first to sign the lease? And this will be done in phases. The first phase that we're looking at will deliver a reasonable number to start off with. We'll see what the demand is like, and then that'll give us the opportunity to develop more fairly soon after, I hope.
I think one of the concerns that we've had raised from a resident is that when they bought their property, and this might not be, I don't think this was the words of the council, but the developer selling the property said, oh, the land behind your home, that's not going to be built on. And they might have meant by that not houses, and obviously there aren't houses there, so that statement's possibly true. But if you take that statement as it's going to remain grass until time immemorial, then those residents are perhaps a bit annoyed. And maybe their annoyance at the council in that instance is unfair because it wasn't the council that said it, was a developer. But that's one of the issues that we've come across, is the residents are saying, we were meant to be looking out over a field and now there's a pump track there. And of course, they probably don't dislike the fact that young people or older people can get on their bikes and get some exercise. But it wasn't an expectation when they bought their home, basically.
I do think that when buying a house, you talk to the people who are selling it. Always caveat emptor applies. Buyer beware. I remember the things that were told to me by the developers when I was looking. And I got my solicitor to check them out to see which were true and which weren't. It's difficult because the sales staff are there to sell houses, and maybe they have the wrong end of the stick, or they don't quite understand what the future is, or they're not up to date with what the activity of the council is. But the advice would always be, surely, if you're buying something from somewhere, particularly a major purchase, check it out. You wouldn't buy a new car from, you know, a lock-up garage, would you? So, you know, check things out. Make sure that things are as they should be.
OK, well, let's go back now to, you were talking about the Cranbrook expanding its boundaries, being a lot more houses in the future. And it would seem prudent not to repeat any past mistakes from that initial development. Would you say there are any lessons to be learned from Cranbrook?
There are an immense number of lessons to be learned from Cranbrook. And actually, the District Council, now that EDDC is looking at a second new town on the outskirts of Exeter, it has taken the Cranbrook experience on board and is looking to do things in a very different way for the development of the next new town. And certainly the initial development of Cranbrook and how it goes into those expansion zones will also be a little bit different. One thing that is going to be significantly different, I think, is that the original 3,500 has been built by a consortium of developers. So you've had three or four major developers have come together to create a business which has, for them, delivered the town centre for their development. The expansion zones will be developed by individual developers. There won't be a consortium which is going to have, if you like, an overall control of what's going on. Each individual developer will need to put forward its own individual planning application, and each will be obviously, as always, treated on its merits. But it will mean that it's a more complicated way of doing it for the District Council, because the planning office, which is already very busy, it is going to have to look at a lot more individual applications than was previously the case. But it is going to be done in that way rather than as a consortium-led model.
You said in a December meeting at East Devon on the topic of a second new town that the District Council needed to exercise a lot more control over what is built than it did with Cranbrook. Are you confident this will be done?
That's the major difference, I think, that will apply to the new town. I think that all the councillors and the leadership at East Devon understand the need for it, the kind of way in which it ought to be done. I mean, there's been nothing agreed on this yet, but the kind of ideas that are being applied are the sort of things that applied to Milton Keynes, for example, when that was first built, because that was built under a development corporation which had an immense amount of power, essentially, over what went where and when.
Was that a public body, was it?
I believe it was, yes. Don't quote me on that, but I think so. But the idea, this new town will be for sure that the district council or whatever body replaces it is going to have a lot more control over timescales and particularly the delivery of the public estate. So it's going to be open spaces and where schools are going and when and where the roads will be built and so on.
The thing that Ali and I hear repeatedly in planning meetings is that there are not enough services in this community, which pick whichever one you want to, for new homes. So is that going to be a key thing of what you're focusing on as well, that you want some actual services there before people move in?
Well, yes, the essential services that Cranbrook did address in the first instance were things like roads and schools, which is obviously important. I personally would like to see more emphasis on provision of medical services than was the case in Cranbrook, because we're still very short on that front. The medical practice in Cranbrook's doing a sterling job, but there are not enough doctors, and I think that's a national problem anyway. There is not yet a dentist practice in Cranbrook, and the town council and indeed the district council are working very hard to try to create the facilities to enable those things to come in. We have to work with the NHS on that, and as we know, they're fairly strapped for money all the while, and getting it funded is always a problem.
One thing you haven't mentioned is sewage provision. I understand there were suggestions that Cranbrook was supposed to get its own sewage treatment works, but never materialised. Has that been a major mistake?
I believe it has been, yeah. South West Water, at the time that Cranbrook was first proposed, were asked to look at the plans, of course, as they do with any development. And the engineers, I think, at the time said that a sewage treatment works would be required. South West Water at the time looked at the plans for the town, looked at their existing infrastructure, and said that actually sewage treatment works wouldn't be necessary and that the system was capable of dealing with whatever came their way.
Can anyone ever falsify? This is the problem with South West Water, though, isn't it? They can say this, and they're the lead authority, they're the experts, but is it in the council's gift to actually question that, and if so, know that the answer in return to that question is true?
I don't think that the district council has the ability to challenge what is essentially a technical answer to say to them, no, actually, we don't believe that. We think that's wrong. You've got to build one, because the water company would just turn around and say, well, we've done our numbers. We're right. There's no need. I think history has shown that actually that was not the right decision. And South West Water were asked to come and have a chat with the councillors at a meeting going back probably 18 months ago now, and it was explained by them at the time that a sewage treatment work for Cranbrook would involve piping all the way down to halfway down the ex estuary, which they described as very difficult.
Well, very difficult it may be, but I guess it's the point of whether it's required or not, isn't it? And that must come down to, in so many planning applications that we hear, just that sort of, you know, the validity or veracity, I guess, of a water company saying we don't need something when they obviously have a budget to keep to, and it may well be that their assessments are correct. But I guess, yeah, it's interesting for you to say, and I think others have said as well, that the council's just, it's very difficult for you to say to them, no, we don't believe you're wrong, because you obviously don't have that expertise in-house as a council.
No, we don't. We don't have water engineers who are able to assess their responses to that level. Just as a footnote on that one as well, when we had that meeting with them 18 months ago, when they did say it was difficult, I challenged them and asked whether that actually meant it was just too expensive for them.
And what did they say to that?
Nothing.
Which probably means maybe it was.
Well, you might think that.
Does that mean you may be in a similar situation when it comes to the new town then? Councillor Todd Olive, who chairs the Strategic Planning Committee, told us last year that there would be a red line around the new sewage treatment works for the proposed new community, meaning that we want that built and operational before any dwellings are occupied. Do you think Councillor Olive and East Devon can fulfil that aspiration?
I would sincerely hope so, yeah. I think that we now have the evidence of history to show that these large-scale developments do need effective water treatment, sewage treatment. And I think that the current questioning going on in Parliament regarding the performance of water companies with regard to pollution incidents will actually add some more impetus to that, because I do think that polluting our waterways and our coasts in the way that it's been done is a national scandal, and it really does need to be sorted out, and money has to be spent by the water companies to provide the equipment to do the work.
We've mentioned strategic planning there, which is a committee at East Devon that you sit on, and it's biggest task recently has been working on the emerging local plan, which is effectively deciding where new homes and businesses could go. It's been a very hard fought committee. I think you spent hard work over the past few months doing that. Are there any sites that you regret allocating now? I know it's still going through and there's going to be a consultation and everything, but when you look back at the process, are there sites that you think, oh, I wish we hadn't actually allocated that one for whatever reason, that the land is too near a special site of scientific interest or something?
I think I can say no, I don't regret any of the allocations that have taken place, given the requirement to provide the building land to meet the government's targets. I do regret that the government targets are as large as they are. I think that the current one particularly is unrealistic, just my view.
Because East Devon's is around, I forget the exact figure, it was around 900 a year or something, isn't that correct?
It's about 950 in the plan that is going to be presented to government shortly. And in fact, we have worked as quickly as we did on that plan, because if it were delayed by even a matter of a couple of weeks beyond the point where we completed it, the target would have gone up to 1,150. Another 200 perhaps doesn't sound that many, but in East Devon, it is a lot, particularly when you bear in mind that really only one third of East Devon can be developed, because two thirds of the district is what is now called National Landscapes. It used to be called Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty, where development is restricted down to virtually zero.
So do you think then that the government housing targets should be different for rural areas, or there should be some sort of metric that helps account for what you've just outlined?
Well, the government use an algorithm that tells them scientifically and mathematically, based on the acceleration in house prices, what the demand for housing is in any given area. We've always felt that that was flawed science, because as we know, the Southwest is a lovely place to live. It's a place that attracts a lot of inward migration, people working but also people retiring. So the housing market in the Southwest has always been very strong, probably never more so than now. Where we should be looking at housing targets, I believe, is what the local need is, and that the market, if you like, for those people moving in out of choice should be whatever that market is. Controlling markets for things like property is full of pitfalls, and it's difficult to think off the top of my head how it would be done. But that's where we are with it. So, but the fact is that the government have come up with these numbers and have simply said, right, well, there's your target. That's the number you've got to build. Find the land for it and get on with it. So these land allocations, I don't personally regret that the allocations have been made, but I just think it's a bit of a shame that they had to be.
And I guess you're touching on an important issue there, because the number of homes you have to hit, and there's probably some sort of punishment or retribution if you don't, perhaps. But the thing that you touched upon there was the fact that Devon needs houses that local people who work here can afford. But you don't really have any control over that, do you?
No, I mean, if I may go back to Cranbrook for a second, I think one of the great successes of Cranbrook has been that it has enabled thousands of people now to get onto the housing ladder that probably wouldn't otherwise have been able to do so, because the house prices relative to the local market have been significantly cheaper. You know, probably caught up a bit now, but to begin with, people were able to buy, and particularly with the government schemes that were available at the time, able to buy houses that they'd have otherwise had no chance. So that is a successful way ahead. It does rely, of course, on a lot of government support. The houses that are needed in Devon, I think, now, particularly for young people and young families, because there is a lot of outward migration of young people seeking work with better incomes elsewhere. And the gap between house prices and average incomes in the southwest is worse than anywhere else in the country, I think, with the possible exception of central London. So it's difficult for people, and actually providing decent, affordable houses is difficult, but it can be done and it should be done.
Can I finally ask you, you're an independent member of the District Council, so I'm keen to get your view on something that is a bit party political. East Devon District Council leader Paul Arnott is running for a seat in the Devon County Council elections on the 1st of May. If he wins, do you think he should step down as leader of the District Council, or do you think it's okay for him to hold both posts?
Mr. Arnott, if I know him at all, is a man who's well able to make his own mind up on these things. I think that in practice, he would find it difficult to do all those things at once. Whether he has a plan to make those change or make that change if he gets elected, I honestly don't know. Would it be the right thing to do? I think he would have to work out what he can do where and what's to the benefit of the people of East Devon and obviously the wider Devon for as long as East Devon District Council and Devon County Council last, because by the time these elections are over, we may only be looking at a few years before the whole thing is replaced with the new unitary and strategic authorities anyway.
Absolutely. We've got that joy to come in the coming years as to how local government in East Devon and wider Devon shakes out. Well, Councillor Blakey, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for coming to see us. It's greatly appreciated, and it's great to hear the latest on Cranbrook and your views on things like planning and everything else. So thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Devoncast Radio is the speech station from Radio X.
And we educate and give people advice so they can make informed decisions about their finances.
And you could be on it.
Devoncast reports on the big decisions and the small ones that affect our wonderful county.
With your podcast broadcast to Devon and professionally produced at Radio X.
And then obviously COVID happened, and within COVID it completely changed the dynamics of children.
Find Devoncast Radio on digital radio or on the Radio X app.
You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app, from your regular podcast provider, and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB digital radio across most of the county.
Still to come on Devoncast, we get the view from Fenerton about a recent planning application for 35 homes in Burlandsmead. Radio X's Paul Nero talks to the organisers of Budley Salterton's Literary Festival. We'll learn about the new link between Plymouth and the Nordic nation Finland. And there'll be some chim-chim-cheree with the Theatre Royal's Mary Poppins.
First, though, let's return to East Devon, where a planning application in Fenerton was approved earlier this month, much to the dismay of residents. Brad, you covered the planning meeting. Can you tell us what's been going on?
Yes, Ali, absolutely. So residents of Fenerton, which is in East Devon, turned out in force to the planning committee meeting to plead their case in relation to a proposal for 35 homes in the town. A total of 55 formal objections were submitted in writing to the scheme, but residents who turned up to speak at the meeting raised a host of fears, and arguably none more worrisome than the fact that sewage already rises in the streets on occasion and backs up in people's homes. Residents gave accounts of raw sewage washing into their gardens, pungent smells, and advice including to use buckets to go to the toilet in or to stuff items down their toilets to prevent foul water rising up into their bathrooms. Add to this, East Devon is spending millions of pounds on the flood alleviation scheme in Fenerton, which the fourth and final phase is set to be completed in autumn. The village is well known for flooding, and residents fear that even with the flood alleviation scheme, the new 35-home development will exacerbate flooding risk in their community. The plan was debated for around 2 hours by the planning committee and was passed with 6 votes in favour, 3 members voting against and 3 abstaining. I spoke to Councillor Alistair Bruce, who represents Fenerton on East Devon District Council, and started by asking him his views on the fact the scheme was approved in spite of the strength of residents' objections.
To be honest, it highlighted one of the major shortfalls that we come across in planning. I've been in as a district councillor now for over 15 years, and I tell you what, I've come across so many cases like this where the community turns up, the parish, the district councillor turns up, and they give a presentation on the real-life things that are impacting that community. And like we saw last week, we all spoke for getting on for over half an hour with some very clear evidence that was real life situations that the Fenerton residents were encountering. And yet, at the end of the day, it counted for absolutely nothing, because in planning law, there is no way of taking that kind of information into account, be it sewage, be it floods. It's comprehensively wrong, because we can't take moral stands and moral information into the planning committee.
And the issues then raised, just so obviously for people listening to this who won't have listened or won't know Fenerton very well, but the issues raised were really quite stark, weren't they, related to sewerage and suggestions that it comes up in the street in Fenton sometimes and even backs up into people's houses.
It is absolutely serious. And I know, sitting where I was, that at least half, possibly more, of the committee were moved by that information, and rightly so. And I suspect that had it just gone as a vote to approve that application, we may have found the committee refusing. Unfortunately, one of the committee members decided to put in a motion to object, which effectively gives the officers, who, to be fair to them, they're doing their job, pointed out that the reasons that were floating around the room at that point, be it sewage, be it flooding, were reasons that they couldn't defend were the application to go to appeal. And so I was wondering, and I have spoken to the chairman about this, that I did feel that the officer's tone perhaps was a little, shall we say, on the aggressive side. And I'll quote one lady who was sitting behind me, that she felt that the committee had been browbeaten into submission by those two officers. And again, I reiterate, I'm not having a go at them because they have a job to do. I think they were a bit over keen on what they were doing. And certainly there was a couple of points that were made that suggested that were the application to go through, South West Water would somehow step up to the plate and improve the situation in that corner of Fenerton, with no evidence to back that up. And it's almost the same as saying, gosh, well, if we pass this application, perhaps Great Western will put on some extra trains and make the parkway at Fenerton a little bit more viable. Those are situations, and those are sort of comments that you cannot take into account when it comes to planning.
With the officers, they have a job to do, and they're in a very tricky situation, I guess, because if they see the planning committee going towards a rejecting a scheme, they then have to ask the committee for those reasons, don't they? And then they have to say, they have to assess those reasons from a legal perspective and a strength of conviction in them in terms of being put against the, you know, to the planning inspectorate in an appeal. So I guess the officers are in a difficult position, aren't they? Because they want the council to have their 5-year land supply and to hit their annual housing targets, etc. Yeah. So do you have some sympathy for them, even if you think they were a bit, in your sort of words, a bit sort of strong-handed this time?
I do. It's a difficult call to make. And when we look on ballots, the number of applications that come through, to be fair to them and to the committee, they don't always get it right. And we have situations where appeals are won and lost quite regularly. And it would be nice for me to have at the tip of my fingers some examples for you to show, you know, how often the committee gets it right as opposed to the officers. I don't have that. But we have recently lost a big one on appeal, and I haven't managed to find out whether that was the officer's recommendation that went through or it was against officer's recommendation.
Was that the Knoll application in Sydney?
Yes. So that just shows that it's not always. And I found in my experience of planning that, you know, yes, they have a job to do. They're quite correct to point out the information to the councillors. It's often that the way they do it, but also sometimes you've got to kind of think, well, let's just test this, because as I've said, there are many examples where applications have fallen and then been won on appeal, both for the applicant and also for the council. So in my years of experience, I've seen enough cases where sometimes when it comes down to one person, i.e. the planning inspector, there is often a situation where he or she may well take a small amount of that information that came from the residents into their deliberations.
Coming back to the Fenerton case specifically, you raised the point there I was going to ask about South West Water. So it was Wendy Ormsby, who's obviously one of the senior planning officers at East Devon. My recollection was that she said something along the lines of, if this scheme is passed in Fenerton, it will kind of create a bit of impetus for South West Water to do work to improve the situation in Fenerton. And she didn't directly say this bit, but ergo suggesting that without this scheme, South West Water might not pay as much attention to Fenerton. Did you catch that comment from her? And are you hopeful now that she said that and the scheme has been approved that there'll be some magical action from South West Water in Fenerton?
Oh, well, I did. And I was quite deeply disappointed in that, because that was, again, another example of perhaps unintended leverage on the committee to say, you know, this could happen. Again, there are no guarantees it could happen. You know, South West Water have an appalling record when it comes to communication with the councils around Devon and Cornwall. And we saw the chief exec on TV recently in the Parliamentary Select Committee, and she couldn't answer the reason why she had not presented herself to the media over the Brixham spill. So I have zero confidence in them. And I don't think, to be honest, that that will make a huge difference, because their track record speaks for itself.
And so are you worried then that you are now a councillor for an area that is about to get more houses in an area that you're worried is already liable to flooding, but worse than that, it might actually be flooded with sewage even perhaps?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And we seem pretty powerless to do anything about it. The situation now in Fenniston is enough, way more than enough, for South West Water to step up to the plate without having to have any incentive of a new application for 35 houses. The situation is real now and it needs to be sorted now.
And have you, presumably, this might sound like a silly question, but presumably you and the community have been trying, have you? What means have you tried to get South West Water to deal with the issues as you see them in Fenniston?
I think there's been an enormous amount of communication. Sadly, I suspect, and certainly in my case, in one direction, I've called for meetings, you know, and et cetera, and they never turn up, or they just don't even reply to your emails. Their communication skills is really, really poor, particularly given this day and age when it's so easy to do. There are absolutely no excuses for the situation in Fenniston. And, you know, I really feel for the people who have to put up with this. You know, it's really hard to imagine being told, when your toilet backs up, to stuff down a pillow to stop it spilling out. I mean, this is a ridiculous situation in this day and age.
And that was actual advice, was it, given to a resident?
I can't confirm whether that was the case, but I think that's the intimation that I was given to understand. Not necessarily from South West Water, I have to say, but certainly that came from somebody.
Lastly, obviously the council, East Devon District Council, is spending quite a lot of money on a floods alleviation scheme in Fenniston. Will that not, you know, alleviate some of these issues in Fenniston, or are you worried that actually that's a bit of a red herring where this planning application is concerned? So I think part of the rationale from officers was, well, we've got flood alleviation as well, and I'm sure South West Water would come good, so it'll all be fine, but... Are you worried actually that the extra pressure that this new housing scheme will put on Fenniston, you know, the flood alleviation scheme actually won't have the impacts that people think it will?
The whole system has yet to be tested. That's the key thing. As I said at my presentation at that council meeting, that in the 10 years that I've been here, I've witnessed two once-in-a-lifetime flood events. So whatever we think about climate change, the reality is that it's ramping up year on year. We get more storms, and if we don't get more storms, we get more intense versions of the storms that we used to get. So it hasn't been tested yet. It's not completed. And also, and whether they've resolved this or not, I don't know. But I understood some time back that there was some concerns that some of the pipework that had been originally planned was actually the wrong size. Now, whether this has been resolved or not, I don't know. But either way, I am really concerned about how much future-proofing is in that drainage system, because if it's been designed just to cope with what we have today in terms of housing, then clearly it makes no sense to add more and more houses. And 35 doesn't sound a huge amount, but it's where it is. It's always critical in Fenniston exactly where these estates get built, because basically the whole of the new part of Fenniston is on one large sort of sloping floodplain going towards the River Otter.
That was Councillor Alastair Bruce speaking to me there. It's important to say that Planning Officer Wendy Ormsby did state in the meeting that the approval of the scheme came with various conditions, including related to sewage and surface water drainage. She said one of the conditions required South West Water to conduct an assessment of the ability and capacity of the existing sewage system in the area to take any additional foul waste from the new development. She said the condition seeks to ensure that if it is identified that there is not capacity, then mitigation works would be required, meaning South West Water would need to upgrade the necessary infrastructure. Because those conditions were in place, she says it made it hard for the committee to refuse the application on flooding and sewage issues because of the conditions attached to the approval. Here's Ms. Ormsby.
Members will be aware of Woodbury, which we've recently granted 3 consents around Woodbury, and South West Water are convening a meeting this week, actually, with the 3 developers inviting us as officers to attend, to look and to start having those conversations about what is going to happen to meet the needs of those developments coming forward. So it was a rather long way round of saying no. I think if this development does not come forward, there is an impetus for them to be having to follow their statutory duties to provide for new housing. So there should be certainty that these new developments will not make the situation any worse. But there is the possibility that the situation could then be improved beyond the site, so there could be a betterment.
That was Wendy Ormsby there, a senior planning officer at East Devon District Council.
You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB radio across most of the county.
Still to come, the Finns come to Plymouth. We hear about Buddy Salton's Literary Festival and the Mary Poppins star talks to our Radio X colleague, Jamie Taylor. So, Ali, can you tell us a bit more about this new collaboration between Finland and Plymouth?
Yes, so the Ambassador of Finland, Jorka Siorkasaara, opened a new honorary consulate in Plymouth on Friday. An honorary consulate represents one country in another, promoting mutual interest, trade and investment. The consulate in Plymouth will cover the whole of the southwest, as well as developing opportunities for business. It aims to deepen cultural and economic ties between Finland and the UK and offer support for the local Finnish community in the region. The ambassador met with business and education leaders at the offices of international lawyers Womble Bond Dickinson at Ballard House, where the consulate and consul, Finland-born Christina Tolvis Vincent, will be based. He then headed off to visit some of Plymouth's leading marine autonomy firms and the university. I managed to catch up with him during a very busy schedule to ask him about his visit.
Well, firstly, I must say that I'm really happy to be in Plymouth and to open the honorary consulate. The consulates are an important resource for us in business promotion, but also building cultural ties and human ties between the two countries. What I have been especially impressed about Plymouth so far is the amount of manufacturing that the city seems to have, and also the export orientation of the companies that you have here. It is important for countries like Finland and the UK to have a strong dynamism in the business sector to be sure that the societies and the countries are economically viable also in the future, and that certainly seems to be the case here.
And is there things that you've learned today from your conversations with people about specific areas of business or education that you think could be really advantageous?
Well, clearly the defence sector is strong here, and I've talked with several companies who are involved in that side of business. I've also met and talked to several people in the education system. There seems to be a high demand for skills, obviously, in this part of England as in the whole country, and it is crucial for me to see that we can connect the local education institutions with Finnish ones and learn from each other, and hopefully also to have exchanges in forms of students and teachers.
And what can the honorary consulate do? You know, it's great here today, everyone's talking. What can it actually physically do?
Well, it can build bridges. So it would be the first point of contact, sort of window to Finland in Plymouth. We work closely together with the consulate from the embassy. So Christina, as the honorary consul, has a direct line to the embassy, and we can then guide her and help her in finding the right contacts in Finland when there is a demand for a Finnish customer for a business, for example, or then the other way around, if there's a Finnish company that is interested in establishing operations here, be they sales or production or whatever, that they have somebody who knows the culture locally, but also can act as a sort of an interpreter between the different modes of operating. Finland and the UK are not that far from each other culturally, but I still think to have somebody who knows, and in the person of Christina, somebody who also knows the legal environment, is really valuable.
Are you surprised about the amount of industry down here?
I must say I'm positively surprised by the dynamism and the will to cooperate and look for new markets. In some other parts of the country, I've noticed that they are very centered in serving the domestic market only. But my view is that despite the fact that the UK is not within the single market, the European single market is still your most important destination for your exports. So you have to look over the channel and beyond. We are not as close as some of the Central European countries in terms of physical distance, but Finland is an interesting partner, I think, also in R&D and innovation. So that is something else that we are trying to foster.
That was a Finnish ambassador, Jorka Siorkasaara, in Plymouth last week. Among the guests was Tim Jones of the South West Business Council, who spoke of the potential opportunities ahead.
The South West is hugely ambitious to build our international relationships. Since Brexit, we've been looking for the next entry points around the world, and we've started to understand how we can do that. So this initiative today is hugely valuable. It brings the Finnish to us. We've got a point of contact both here and in London, and we've started looking out to see how surprisingly many Finnish businesses are either working here or we're linked with already. And we're also seeing how many students and tourists who come and enjoy what today is a rather nice weather day. So all of those things mean that this is a really important occasion for us and something we will be wanting to repeat over and over again. The more contacts we can make at this sort of level, the better the South West is going to be in terms of its international relationships.
What do you think of the growth at the moment in Plymouth of the marine and green industries? They're talking about 8,000 new jobs over the next few years. I mean, this is going to help that, isn't it?
The marine industry is piloted for lots of good reasons as one of the really leading edge global businesses that we've got in the South West and indeed in the country. What the university do, what our marine businesses do, led by Babcock's, obviously with their huge investment programmes, is absolutely leading edge. The South West leads on this stuff. We're very, very good at it, and we need to keep ahead of the market. This is a very important sector for us, and whatever the Finnish can do to help us with that, because they have a huge amount of collective experience, then bring it on. That's exactly what relationship building we need to ensure that these important businesses can keep growing.
Mm. Plymouth wants to skill more people, and it's one of the things is, you know, it feels it's the cities maybe not skilled enough. So having a link like this, do you think that could help students maybe go to Finland, maybe learn things, maybe just, you know, widen their knowledge and be the right people for the jobs later on?
Well, there are lots of learning experiences. We beat ourselves up about the lack of skills we've got, and we beat ourselves up about the lack of young people who make a career down here. We educate them and then they disappear. We need to turn that round, and the marine industry is one of those opportunities. The chance of collaborating with somewhere as exciting as Finland is just another example of how we can do that. For a young person who's just finished their education to be able to have some exchange relationship with a collaboration through the consulate is just exactly what they're looking for. So if we can do that, and we can do it not only in marine but in the nuclear sector. They're currently building a power station, nuclear power station in Finland, which is very similar to Hinkley. They're learning a lot of the work experiences that we are learning about at the Hinkley project at the moment. It's those sort of areas of absolute leading-edge technical expertise that we need to be developing.
Tim Jones, Chairman of the South West Business Council, speaking there. Professor Kevin Jones, Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research and Innovation at Plymouth University, is also looking forward to building links with Finland.
We were the second university in the UK to become net zero, and I would say the first proper full-scale university, because the other one was London School of Economics, and it's a bit different. But so because of that, the whole idea of sort of sustainability in everything from food production through architecture into energy, particularly sort of ocean-based offshore energy, those are things we and so our students really care about. So being able to find sort of simpatico places, and just from the conversations we've heard today, is clearly Finland is one of those. So I think it would be very useful, and they're coming to visit the university later on, as I think you know, being able to show the kind of things we do, and having somebody local who reminds us, oh yeah, it's worth looking at that link, I think will be really helpful to sort of students, and of course staff from a research point of view as well.
That was Professor Kevin Jones from Plymouth University, one of three universities in the city. Plymouth also hopes it can learn from Finland as it looks to expanding its creative industries and cultural sector. Here's Plymouth City Council's deputy leader, Jemima Lang, explaining why the visit by the ambassador will help keep people talking about the city.
Anything that continues to keep putting us on the world stage, on the global stage, and to feature in conversations. I know now that the ambassador, when he goes back to London, he will talk about what an amazing time he had in Plymouth. I know he's going to see some of our really important marine businesses in the city later today. So, yeah, I think, you know, we know we really are on the tip of something really big happening for Plymouth around jobs, housing, my particular interest and area of culture, you know, the box really becoming a not just a nationally known place, but a globally known artistic institution, cultural institution. So, yeah, there's so much going on. And on a beautiful day, in the room that we're sitting in, we have this incredible view over Plymouth Sound and the breakwater. And it's an incredible place to live. And more people are really getting that message.
Jemima Lang of Plymouth City Council there. So all in all, a positive day for Plymouth, and with the addition of good weather, which always helps.
You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB digital radio across most of the county.
Still to come, we're going to hear about Budleigh Salterton's Literary Festival, and then it's time for a supercalifragilistic expialidocious insight into the Theatre Royal's production of Disney's classical musical Mary Poppins.
So, spring is here, and with it, the Devon social calendar gets underway. In East Devon, it's the Budleigh Salterton Spring Literary Festival. We're here recording on Friday, the 6th of March, so you may be a little too late this time round, but the lineup is strong, and if you are listening in time, some tickets are still available on the doors. John Suchet explains his love of Beethoven. Sir Graham Brady, once the key man in grey suit who told Theresa May, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss their time was up, discusses the Prime Ministers he dispatched. Best-selling writer Sinclair McKay discussed Sir Winston Churchill in 90 Encounters, and much more too. Radio X is broadcast media sponsor of the festival. Its chair, Sue Briggs, told the station's Paul Nero that the spring event mainly covers non-fiction.
The first time we did it was during COVID, which we had to do by video link. And actually it went down so well, we thought we would run it, you know, with as a sort of spring festival treat. We just use one venue, but this year we've got seven events, which is more than we've ever had before. We tend to have non-fiction, so we haven't. Fiction is the big vacancy this time, but that's how it works, sells very well. And because it's 2 days, we feel people can pick and choose how they want to have their non-fiction events in March, and then of course in September they'll have the whole array of everything.
And it's a change of the guard. You've got a new artistic director of the festival.
We have indeed, Paul. Her name is Kate Abbey, and she lives and works in Bath. She's building on the great festivals of the past that was provided, put together by our previous artistic director, but it's actually also a chance, a bit of fresh air and a few changes. So we're looking forward to this programme she's put together is fascinating. So we're looking forward to seeing what she's going to bring to us, bring to Budleigh for September.
And generally, how hard is or easy is it to put together a literary festival these days? We're in a literary area, aren't we, in Budleigh Salterton, that part of East Devon. People like their books.
They do indeed, and I think they like the challenge of listening to people and conversations that ensue. But it's not easy, to be honest, Paul. There's several things. I think, you know, the lack of sponsorship from Baillie Gifford didn't affect us personally, but it also means that things have to be considered more carefully, and there's less money to spend on production, but also on our charitable outreach. It's also, our location is absolutely glorious here in East Devon, but it's not easy to entice authors down here, which is another reason why Kate Abbey, I think, will be, she's got a real Southwest perspective. So we'll be working with Appledore Festival in September, trying to sort of bring authors to both here in Budleigh and to Appledore as well at the same time. And that helps, you know, so it's like an author comes one place and gets two hits, really.
That was Paul Nero there speaking to Sue Briggs, the chair of the Budleigh Salterton Literary Festival.
So now let's talk a little bit about the Theatre Royal's production of Disney's classical musical Mary Poppins. Radio X's Jamie Taylor caught up with the leading lady Stephanie Jones to hear about what it's like flying on stage and how she got the role.
I remember when the show was announced in Australia that it would be coming to Australia. I had that feeling instantly in my heart and in my tummy that I really wanted to do it. But, you know, this industry is really hard and you get a lot of knockbacks. You get far more no's than you do yeses. So I guess, as a bit of self-preservation, I tried to trick myself into thinking that I didn't want it that bad. But then, of course, once the audition process started and I got my hands on some of the material and I was in the room working with the creatives, I knew instantly how much I wanted it and how I felt I could do a good job. So I'm so glad that it went my way. It really was a dream come true to get that phone call.
It's got to be a pretty tough process. What sort of things did you have to do? And is it true as well that Cameron McIntosh himself handpicked you for the role?
That is true.
Wow. Yeah.
Cameron cares deeply about many things, but especially his leading actors having good chemistry and being able to bounce off of one another and work together well. So he has always, since Mary Poppins has ever been a thing, you know, for 20 years now, he always makes sure that he sees his Mary and Bert's in the room together.
Incredible.
Do a bit of a chemistry read. And he does have final say. So when we finally got to that stage of the process where we were working with him on the West End stage during the day when they didn't have rehearsals or weren't doing a show, we were on the stage during some tricky COVID times, and we got to work with Cameron for many hours. And he was so generous, actually, with his knowledge of not only his show, but his relationship with P.L. Travers, who, you know, handed him the rights to these books to turn them into a stage musical. With, she had many conditions. She wanted it to be a certain way, and he has honoured her by maintaining those promises. And so he's very careful with how the show is presented and who he casts. So I guess, yeah, it did feel like a real honour to be given that tick of approval.
Amazing. So a lot of boxes ticked.
Yes, I think so.
And
you're very happy.
You fly in the show. That isn't a spoiler, is it? I can say that, can't I?
I don't think it's a spoiler. I think it's spoiler. Something that people know, and that's one of the reasons why they want to come along. They want to have a look. And I can tell you it's epic for the audience to see, but it's epic for me as well. It's
such
a rewarding thing to be able to do. I really love it.
What was it like the first time? That's got to be pretty scary.
Oh, it was exhilarating. I'm luckily not afraid of heights, although they didn't ask me that in the audition, which I thought they might.
And they missed that bit out.
Yes, can you imagine? But look, it was truly exhilarating. I think there are many actors out there who hope to one day be able to fly in a show or on a set of a movie. So it's a big box tick moment. I really love it.
Would you say it's your favourite part in the show?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's so unique, but there are so many other parts that I just love so much. And it changes, and it can change depending on what city we're in and what kind of audience reaction we're getting. But I actually really love Feed the Birds, which I sing with the Birdwoman, who's played by the amazing Patti Boulay, because the show is so spectacular visually. There's so much to take in. There's incredible sets and costumes and lighting design. But Feed the Birds is a really pared back, simple number with a really important message, I think, and it's got such a beautiful orchestration. So I really enjoy that moment of stillness.
And so far, so obviously you're performing in front of Plymouth audiences. How are we faring in terms of, I know you've taken this show, you know, all over the world and stuff like that. How are we faring at the moment? We good?
Oh, yeah. No, you're good. You guys are great. You actually, we've noticed you really listen. So we initially felt, oh, Plymouth feels a bit quiet compared to where we had just been in Edinburgh. But now we realise you're actually really listening and really taking it all in. And then at the very end of the show, every night, this amazing standing ovation, big cheers, clapping, like it's such an amazing response. So it's just really lovely to see that, like, they have been with us the whole show and they've just been really listening and taking it in, and they're so moved by the end. It's been a really nice house to play to.
So when the curtain opens, obviously we know the story, but in terms of the musical, what can people expect? Is it just extra songs? Is there a twist? You know, what can people expect if they've watched the film and they're going to go along? Where does it start?
I mean,
how do we go?
There are some extra songs, which we actually sort of even forget ourselves that they weren't initially a part of the original movie, because they've been so perfectly crafted. They just slot in so beautifully alongside all the original Sherman Brother numbers. I mean, the show's been going for 20 years now, so there are some songs in our musical that are just as famous as the songs from the movie. And it is the movie on stage. People will come and see what they know and love, but it is also equal parts, if not more so, the books by P.L. Travers, which was what she wanted. You know, she quite famously didn't really love the movie of Mary Poppins, which I find so hard to believe because I just think it's so fantastic. But she didn't quite like it. It strayed from her books a bit too much. But part of Cameron's promise was that he would bring the musical back to sort of, you know, the core themes from her books. So we have a lot of special moments from the books up on stage. And I actually saw the musical before I ever read the book. So when I finally went and read the books,
I thought,
oh, this is great how they have lifted this from the page. It's very clever. It's beautifully crafted. It's beautifully written by Julian Fellowes, you know, who wrote Downton Abbey, Gosford Park. So, it's been in the hands of some incredible creatives.
And in terms of building your Mary Poppins, where did you find your inspiration? Did you just go rogue? Did you take things from the film, the book? How did that come about?
I think Julie Andrews has definitely been a big influence on me in many things, not just in this role, but I grew up watching her. I grew up absolutely devouring The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins on rotation. And The Sound of Music is also a show that I've done a number of times. She's just got the voice of an absolute angel. And I don't think I could ever replicate what she did, because she is one in 10,000 billion trillion. But I think she has influenced me. But there's also something about the way that the text is written. And when you apply that standard RP British accent, which is required of her, there's something that happens to the rhythm in the way that you speak. You sort of can't move away from it, but you also don't want to move away from it. It's just something that happens. It's like, oh, there's a rhythm to this speech that suits the character so much. And I really do credit that to the writing.
Yeah. Did you find the accent a challenge? Is it quite hard?
Not for Australians. I think there are many things that we have in common in terms of our sort of colloquialisms and the way we speak. And I'm actually a musician first and foremost. I play the violin, so I do have a good ear for music and accents, and I always have. So for me, it wasn't too tricky at all, which is good. You know, that's a relief, because you don't want to be working on the floor only concentrating on how the words are coming out of your mouth. That could be really draining. I've certainly done other jobs in the past that have been far trickier. Doing, you know, an Irish accent, I think, is tricky, or
a Czech accent.
So the British accent is it comes naturally.
Are we able to get a little blast?
What's a good line? Okay. I wasn't born 1 minute before I walked into your house, Michael Banks.
I love it. Just switch on. You're in. You're there. Oh, it sounds incredible. Just very quickly, why should people come and see you in the show?
It really will deliver on many levels. It's equal parts spectacle and heart. So you do get that visual wow, and you cannot believe the magic and the illusions that you're seeing unfold in front of your eyes, and incredible 11-minute dance numbers that are just so spectacular. But then you have this underlying story that is so heartfelt and precious. You could just hold it in the palm of your hand before she flies away. And it's a very emotional story, but it's so uplifting as well. It truly has everything.
That was Jamie Taylor there, talking to Stephanie Jones from the Mary Poppins production.
And that's Devoncast. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening, and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.